All right, episode 77. We're back, and we're back with Gonzo.
Hey,
welcome back,
going?
Brother.
Yeah, good to be back. Man.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been too long.
It's amazing how that happens, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So much fun. All right, as we did last time, I said, hey, you come up with ideas of what you want to talk about. I'm just happy you're on the podcast, right? So what? Tell the people what we're going to be talking about today.
We're going to talk about graphic design and comic books, man.
All right.
I think an area only you and I could talk about.
Yeah, maybe this is an audience of two.
Yeah, it might be. But listen, I want to think that people who know you probably know some comic stuff.
Yeah.
Some of them. And everyone who's a graphic designer here, nowadays you can't escape comic books. So I think it's, let's talk about the source material here. So this is...
Yeah, for sure.
If you like the Jane Austen movies, let's talk about the books.
Yeah. Well, I've loved comics ever since I was a little kid. I think I told the story. I got sick when I was... a little guy back in the day when we had no remote controls.
Oh, yeah.
And we had three channels on the TV. Clunk, 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 right? Or you had the UHF, right?
Yeah, you had like 56 channels.
Yeah, and my grandfather, Grandpa Bing, they had a flower shop for 50 years out in California. And right across the street was a store called Comics and Comics. Right? Yep. Second Comics with an X because they were crazy.
Oh, man.
I know. Comics and Comics.
Because they were extreme.
Yeah. So he ran over and got a gigantic stack of comic books and brought it. And that was it. Hooked.
Yep.
Done for the rest of my life. What got you into comics?
Spider-Man. I like the cartoon. And then my grandparents...
We both share a love of Spider-Man.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm going to have Thwip in the spiderweb tattoo to my fingers.
But, I know.
My parents and I, we lived in Orange County, the very ass end of Orange County.
Yeah.
All of my grandparents lived in LA County. So they got the LA Times, we got the Orange County Register. The LA Times carried the Spider-Man newspaper strip.
Oh,
and,
nice.
The Orange County Register did not. So it was a daily strip.
Yeah.
So
the Larry Lieber strip, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And Stan wrote it, ostensibly wrote in quote big quotation marks.
Yeah, exactly.
My grandfather, my dad's dad, knew my love of Spider-Man. And he was a guy who read the paper every day.
Like, so did he save all the papers for
him? Yeah, he would clip them out. So I had basically a comic book. And he knew I was into, and honestly, I was watching the old Ralph Bakshi produced 1960s Spider-Man cartoon with the weird psychedelic stuff. And
absolutely.
I dug that.
Great theme song.
But when I saw the graphic style of black and white in the Spider-Man strip in the newspaper,
blew your mind.
That blew my mind. And then my same set of grandparents bought me the 1977 or maybe 76 Marvel rubber stamp set.
Okay.
It had Kirby art in it.
Oh, wow.
And it's like Kirby, Thor, Silver Surfer. First time I saw the Silver Surfer.
Oh, wow.
Captain America. And they were stamps. So
you could stamp whatever you wanted.
Black or white.
You know what I mean?
And it was like hard contrast.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I remember just like inking it up and stamping down the Silver Surfer the first time. And seeing that it looked like a Metallica dude.
And
it was just lines with no shading, anything.
I love how your face is lighting up when you're telling the story too.
Well, I mean, my art style. Like I'm a very bold, kind of artist. Like I like big, bold, I like graphic art.
Yeah.
Obviously. And when I saw that Silver Surfer hit the paper, I was like, oh man, I got to figure out how this guy does that. I mean, not knowing Jack Kirby was or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, seeing, I think in about 77 as well, I got a Power Record. Spider-Man Power Record with the Dragon Men and the Werewolf.
Okay, wow.
Which was Dick Giordano doing the illustration and the Dragon Men, and I forget who does the Werewolf one.
He was doing Marvel stuff. Giordano was so famous for being a DC.
Yeah, so, okay, total funny aside here. I actually talked to Neil Adams about this because it was years, I'd known Neil for, probably a decade at this point.
Yeah.
Or been friendly with,
I mean,
he always knew me, and he knew he liked me because we talked about weird stuff every time we talked.
We were
talking about Megalith and Samurai. Like, we were never, I wasn't asking him about the... Batman or any
all
of that.
The obvious stuff he's answering 10,000 times.
Dude, let's talk about Megalith, man. Let's talk about some continuity garbage. Yeah. But I in like this is probably 5 years ago, so just a little bit before he passes.
Yeah.
I had just found out that he was the guy who had packaged all of the stuff for Power Records to do those comics.
Wow.
Peter Pan Comics had established, or I'm sorry, Peter Pan Records had established, they used to do storybook records, had established Power Records to do all this comic book stuff.
Okay.
Marvel and DC, some Star Trek, some like Sherlock Holmes stuff. It was all, Adams having that studio packaged it all together.
Interesting.
And I'm like, I got to go talk to Neil about this.
Yeah.
And so I walk up like, Neil, man, I just found out you were the guy who put together all that Power Record stuff.
Yeah.
And dude, his face lit up.
Yeah. Cause like, it's like, no one's ever asked me about this. What a great,
Also,
that's how Dick Giordano got in.
This is why he lit up when he said that. He goes, man, those people had no idea what it cost to make a comic book.
Yeah.
And they had a ton of money.
Okay.
So I hired everyone who was good to me.
Yeah.
And I got them overpaid for work. fantastic to make story. To draw the same characters that they were getting underpaid to work at the big studios
yeah,
for.
Yeah.
So Giordano had been, I think, the guy who hired him first.
Wow. Okay. And, makes sense.
And so he hired Giordano to.
But he was
do
an
those.
Art director at DC, I feel like, for
yeah,
a long,
yeah,
long
but
time.
Yeah, but this didn't violate. He wasn't going to Marvel to
yeah,
do
exactly,
work.
Yeah, exactly.
He was going to Power Records
yeah,
to do work.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Power Records was doing DC stuff as well. They did yeah. some great Batman records, some Superman stuff.
Fun.
So yeah, he just hooked all his buddies up. Because
the network, man.
Because he could. He's like, you know, yeah. they, you know, at the time it probably cost, you know, maybe $2,000 to make a comic back then.
Yeah.
He told Power Records it cost $10,000 to make yeah. a comic. And they said, sure.
I said, let's do it.
And then he said, awesome. I'm going to get all of my friends paid. So yeah, it was great to talk to Adams about that. And then apparently, and I might be talking out of turn, but he is gone. Yeah. Apparently, why he ended up not doing that anymore is that the owner of Power Records' wife was sweet on Neil.
Oh boy.
And that's part of why he was getting such a sweetheart deal.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
eventually yeah. the guy who ran it
found out the finances.
And
yeah.
put an end to, well, that's he just put crazy. An end to the, I think it was more of the, that she was sweet on him and less about the money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they were making
course.
Their money back.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
They made a ton
of course.
Yeah. And so the cover of that also has that John Romita Spider-Man.
Okay.
And that John Romita, which is that licensed, you've seen it on, you know, backpacks, everything. Yeah.
It's, would you say John Romita is the definitive Spider-Man
absolutely.
Artist if you take the entire populace of non-comic book people,
yeah, yeah.
I would say that Romita is the definitive. That's who people see
yeah,
when they
were,
think of
if
Spider-Man.
If you were born between like 65 and maybe 90, 95 maybe?
Okay.
Maybe 92. I think kind of the only Spider-Man that you saw until maybe Todd took over as the well, guy who
was John Romita.
Was John Romita.
But even still today, that Romita Spider-Man is still pretty much the one used for a lot of licensing mm-hmm. and a lot of that stuff. So
I mean, that's what it was with the Power Record is that Marvel was like, oh, here's your licensed version.
Yeah.
Then you find an artist. And they did not knowing he was going to find legit comic artists. You know, because so much of, like, because you see those Marvel coloring books and those, some of those Marvel
like
paperbacks.
It's like clip art to a certain extent. Yeah.
Exactly. So,
okay, so that's what got you into comics.
That's what got me into comics, yeah.
Okay,
yeah. So,
awesome.
And then, I wanted to draw comics forever.
Yeah.
Went to the Orange County High School of the Arts where they kind of poo-pooed the idea of comic books.
Really?
Oh,
that's
interesting. Because this was like 1988, you know, when I was in high school. Okay.
Shout out to Sandra Reed. I had a life drawing professor that tried her hardest to break me of the hard outline.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
the hard line from, you know, like the inking style of whatever.
Yep.
She basically spent an entire semester just hammering me on don't draw it like comic, you know what I mean? Just go tone to tone. And I'm like, man, I love it. This is what I love.
Yeah,
you know?
Pull out some Toulouse-Lautrec. And that's the thing that really kind of pushed me back into it. It was because I did end up being like a classically trained artist at the High School of the Arts, but then eventually you discover someone like Lautrec and you're like, he's doing hard outlines.
Yeah,
he's doing comics.
That's exactly.
You know, Japanese Blicken Hokusai. Like that's comics. You know?
Exactly.
So, and then Van Gogh was, you know, ripping off Hokusai and stuff. So I did the High School of the Arts and I mean, it didn't really, they just didn't see any value in it. It was still trash culture, you know, at that point.
Well, it's a weird commercial art. I mean, to a certain extent, advertising and design, we do a tremendous amount of commercial art. That's what we do, right? But it was kind of this weird lower form of commercial art, I guess. You know, a lot of artists and even writers used pen names and things like that, so it wouldn't sully their, you know, storyboard career or their advertising career.
Or their fine art gallery career.
Yeah, exactly. They would do comics under
but
a different name.
It's kind of all I ever wanted to do. Yeah. But
I love comics.
As
I love
kind of
sequential
out.
Storytelling. Oh, I love the whole thing.
I mean, I think it's a uniquely American art form. I mean, I know the Europeans have their kind of take on it and they're kind of getting closer together. But I think that monthly periodical disposable comics.
Yeah.
In a way that have a way to be great that only kind of trash culture can have, was really perfected by America and those Jewish artists in the 30s.
Yeah.
Really, you know, because all the real artists were doing strips.
Yeah,
and then the guys who couldn't quite do that, like, you know, I love amateur enthusiasm more than technical acumen any day of the week.
Well, there was I don't disagree with that, and there was an interesting inflection point too of like being a newspaper. You said, because you said strips.
Yeah.
You know, to be clear, being a newspaper daily comic artist, like writing, like Prince Valiant or Jim Davis with Garfield, you know, like Beetle Bailey, all the, you know, all the classic sort of stuff, that was still a highfalutin. That was good.
Yeah.
That was looked more favorably upon than like, you know.
You had elbow patches in a pipe if you did that sort
of
thing.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
But,
you were like a legit commercial fine artist and all was good in the world versus comic books, which was like, no, that's like kiddie little stuff.
And I mean, even back then, if you were in comics, you were still, you know, dealing with the boys, you know, if you know what I mean? So it was a dirtier world, you know? So, as I got out of high school, as I started pushing toward the end of high school, I actually started, Well, A, I had an art teacher. Like, so I went to like a regular high school for most of the day. The high school of the arts was like the last part of my day.
Okay.
And then I, for whatever reason, I think I just needed credits. I actually took an art class at my regular high school, my regular art teacher.
Sure.
That guy was very encouraging about comic books. Interesting. And saw they had a knack for it.
So where does design mix in on this?
This is where we're getting there. So as that starts pushing, you know, as I start pushing towards graduation, I'm seeing more and more of my artist friends graduate and then have to try to find careers or try to go to school or what have you. And I just saw kind of, you know, class after class and then almost my class of my friends as artists just become starving artists in Los Angeles, like living in these squats in downtown LA and all this stuff.
Boo.
And it was just, it looked real hard, you know, and I've never been great at the politics of any business I've ever been in, whether it be design, comics, tattooing, any of that. Okay. I'm a guy who likes to do good work.
Yeah.
I'm not real great at kind of sussing out like how to navigate people. And I'm also a guy who speaks his mind. So it's hard for me to be kind of political in anything. I just,
I don't think you give yourself enough credit, but keep going.
Okay. I see. I saw the politics of the gallery world, at least in Los Angeles.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And the kind of people that you do have to navigate. And I'm complete, you know, proletariat, like protesty kind of guy, but I'm just the punkest of punk dudes. When I graduate high school, I am the punkest of punks, right?
Yeah.
And so to the idea of maintaining my punk anarchic lifestyle by kissing the butt of, you know, debutantes.
Those two do not go, they don't go well.
I was like, nah, I'm not doing that. And I did spend like a year kind of trying to figure out some way to maintain my principles and still be a creative. And I ended up, I stayed in LA for like a year on my own and my parents had moved to Arizona.
Yeah.
And so, LA is a bad town to be broken. And, you know, after like, you know, 2 months of living in a motel / my car, I finally was like, I'm gonna move in with my parents. And I'm like, when I got there, they're like, what's your plan? And I'm like, I don't know. I think I'm just going to go into like commercial art, which is what we used to call graphic design. Right.
Sure.
And they're like, oh, that sounds cool. So they like, you know, my mom had knew a girl who had gone to this terrible, terrible trade school. I'm going to drop its name, called Al Collins Graphic Design School.
Okay.
And it is, it's like a step below DeVry.
Oh, wow.
You know, but it's graphic design. However, when I was there, Al Collins had just passed, his son was running it, but his curriculum was still there. And Al was a legit ad guy.
Okay.
And had been for years. And so I just got into graphic design. And as I got into kind of the utilizing like the principles and elements of design in a way that, you know, that was abstracted and was these, you know, these elements that weren't illustrative as comic books and stuff. I really just took to it. I'm like, oh, this is kind of like this sensibility that, you know, that kind of Swiss design sensibility that everybody loves. So like that speaks to like what I liked about that Jack Kirby stamp back in the day.
Sure.
And so I just took to it, you know, and then I got my degree and then I just did nothing with it for 5 years. that's when I learned how to tattoo. Like I literally got my degree and offered an apprenticeship in the same month.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, oh, I'm going to tattoo. And I did that for a while. But I did do freelance graphic design to kind of finance my apprenticeship.
Sure.
And then once I started, once I had a kid, I'm like, oh, I should dust off that portfolio so that, you know, I have things like benefits and steady paychecks.
Yeah, absolutely. That's helpful sometimes. Yeah,
like worked in graphic design for, you know, years and years.
So when you think about the confluence of graphic design and comic books, right, well, and comics in general, what spurs to your mind? I mean, I have my immediate thoughts and things like that, but I'm curious to get your thoughts.
I think of like things like logo design, trade dress, all of the things that aren't the art that really go into like the feel of a comic. Because if you look at like a... You know, maybe less
the masthead design.
Yeah, so you look at like the trade dress of Marvel from, you know, like the corner box and the Marvel Comics, you know, Marvel Comic Group across the top, that banner was genius. Something that, you know, then you look at a DC comic with all of its, so DC comics for about 20 years were typically a big color image in the center, right? Like a full color image with a single color, a color hold line work in the background. So it would be like, you know, red on red or a green line work or what have you. And then a lot of words and some like little inset bubbles. And I just think about like the overall look and feel of the DC stuff that happened when Marvel was doing the corner box and then the big, you know, Marvel Comics.
Yeah, DC had almost like, it felt like multiple panels in one on the cover selling you what was happening on the inside, right?
Yeah.
Marvel had kind of just one splash image and, you know, they did have dialogue boxes for quite a long time. Now we don't even get those anymore, right?
Yeah, I put them on there.
But it was still like, it was kind of like, you know, hey, the Thing, what a revolt in development or what, you know what I mean? That, you know, something was happening.
One of these will die.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like a big sort of splashy image and a big call to action. And then that's it.
Back to what we do, comic book covers until about a decade ago were ads.
Yeah.
Like they were just straight up advertising. Absolutely. You know, and so you have your branding on there. You got to get the logo.
Yeah.
You got to get your CTA, you know, you got to get all of that stuff, you know, was in there, and you got to give a little taste. You got to get a little feel. You got to get
You mentioned Spidey, the old Spidey Hobgoblin, you know, who is this guy? You're right. The silhouettes.
Yeah. Yeah. With the question mark.
Question mark inside silhouettes who's going to die. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, is Captain Stacy dying? You know what I mean? Like, there was, it very much was an ad. It's a teaser ad that happens to be illustrated.
And then, you know,
get you to buy this, you know, 60-cent comic book.
And back to, I think, a little bit of what we talked about logo flexibility last time, if anyone listened to that, they got to the point where in comic shops and newsstands, there were so many of them that you wouldn't even see all of the comic, right?
Correct.
So sometimes they'd be overlapping.
Yeah.
Marvel does a genius thing. It makes the corner box. So you can still see. And then Eerie does a thing where it just says horror or terror along the side of it. So even if you just have the tiniest bit of it, you know, again, you know, having the graphic design sense to know where it's going to be
smart.
Seen. You know, like we were talking about, you know, when you're in complete control, this is what it looks like. You see the whole cover and it's all its glory. When it's in a shop and it's living out of your control and some shop owner stacks one book on the other, but just the eighth of an inch sliver, you still see the word terror.
Yeah.
And that's enough to catch a 12-year-old boy's eye. Go, did that say terror? Does it say death? Like, I want to see what's in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So those are the graphic design elements.
It's funny, we're both smiling ear to ear because we know the little nuances that, like, as to the reason why those things were created, but most people probably have no idea. You know what I mean? It's just part of the
charm.
But all those little details really matter.
Absolutely, you know? I mean, and to me, they make a comic book feel like a comic book. Like nowadays, they're just, you know, these clean virgin variants that just have one big image on them.
Yeah,
because they're going to live on a browser now. And so you already have all the information next to it in the hypertext that's in your webpage.
Absolutely.
You don't need to have the title. You don't need to have the issue number. You don't need to have any call out because it's literally going to live next to the thumbnail. Now comic covers are thumbnails.
Yeah.
Before they were ads.
It's so funny. I was going to just mention that basically everything's a thumbnail now.
Yep.
We even have, we work on a music, we have a music client of ours. They do a lot of music publishing. APM and Universal Music and things like that, right? So we do a lot of actual album covers, which is super fun, right?
Yeah.
But it's not the big
12x12.
Yeah, it's not the 12x12 LP, you know, like where of the days of, like, you don't even have any text on there. Like, you think about a Led Zeppelin album cover, it doesn't even say, like, it says nothing anywhere.
Again,
right?
It doesn't need to, you know, because it all of that lives in the hypertext that's going to be set next to it that you have no control over.
Yeah, but now we're basically taking those 12x12s and we're making it a tiny little thumbnail and trying to get everything. You know, we have to think about it backwards almost. You know,
exactly. Well, you can also strip out, you know, again, it's like knowing where things live. And,
yeah.
And the better part of our job is, like, how is this going to be engaged with and with whom?
Context matters.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's the only thing that matters, actually, because I can make something that looks great. Again, looks great. On the dimensional, you know, outdoor sign, you know, and it's backlit and all of that. But hey, how does that look when it's, you know, 120 by 120 or 90 by 90 in your profile?
Social post or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. You gotta consider that. And also, you know, we'll get back a little of that. You know, if you do put that information on the cover, now it looks redundant to all the hypertext that links next to it.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
So you kind of don't, you look like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, comics had a really good feel of turning covers into ads, especially when there were tons and tons of them.
Yeah.
And you know, and telling a bit of the story. It's a little bit of an appetizer. It's like kind of giving you a feel of what's going to happen, whether or not that particular scene tableau on the cover actually is a scene from the book. And in fact, so much so, when it actually did happen in the book, that would be on the cover. This actually happens. You know, this actual image will be seen in the comic book. And you're like, oh, okay, I got to find out if that's a dream sequence or what.
You know, and it's funny, and it varies from publisher to publisher, because a lot of times cover artists were designing things totally agnostic or independent of what was happening with the actual interior pages, right?
Yep.
Sometimes things lined up, sometimes it didn't, you know, and deadlines are deadlines. And, you know, we hear these funny stories about in the 60s or 70s, how an editor would have just a drawer full of covers, you know, and just filler issues, because it really was a disposable periodical that, like, it almost kind of didn't matter if story for story, you know, it's number 178, it's number 179, it's number two, you know,
or
like, they get it out the door.
Slap a new cover on an old issue, you know, and just like, let's give that some new
We had 50 issues of the X-Men that were just reprints, you know what I mean? They just recolored the front. So, what do you think about design on the interior, you know, and graphic design, panel design, you know, as you're sort of navigating through sequential pages of art? Right?
Well, I think where design comes in, I mean, as a guy who's a designer who makes comic books, I do think about the, you know, everything is a two-page spread in a comic book.
Yeah.
You know, so I design that way. I do my thumbnails as you know, one, you know, page one is independent, but I also know what the IFC, you know, the inside front cover is going to be.
Yeah.
And then I design everything as a spread. And then I kind of look at just the, I have, you know, my thumbnails are all 22 pages on a single sheet.
Okay.
So I can see the rhythm of the
flow
entire
of
book.
The
yeah,
entire
exactly.
book.
It's like
yeah.
I got too many small panels at the beginning and then, you know, you never see a panel, you know, you never see a panel at eighth the size of the page again until, you know, the last page. Or so. I mean, that may or may not support the emotional truth of the moment, you know, because comics are about, you know, emotion more than it. Because nobody, you know, this is the same with advertising. Nobody cares about what you write in a comic book and nobody cares about what you draw in a comic book. They care about how they feel about what you've written and drawn. And so everything should support the feeling of that, right?
Okay.
So the same with advertising. No one really cares about the headline or the image, but what they care about is how they feel about
it. Yes. What's the takeaway?
Exactly. And so, you know, I'm a firm believer that every kind of two-page spread should have some kind of emotional journey. So if it starts sad, it should get happy or, you know, there should be some change of emotional state between the upper left and the bottom right.
Yeah.
And then how is that supported by the panel layout, right? Like, you know, if this is a chase scene, it should be a lot of like small little panels to give a kind of frenetic pace.
Yeah.
Or if it's a quiet moment, like, do I make sure that there's a lot, like enough room around the this is just beyond composition.
Yeah.
You know, within the panels, this is just about literally the squares that everything's going to go or the rectangles that everything's going to go in or the shapes, I guess. But I mean, there is that. And I think a lot of that.
Well, it does beg the question, though, nowadays, do you need rectangles or do you need shapes?
Yeah.
You
know I mean, again, if you can go panel to panel.
Breaking out of panels and things overlapping. Mm-hmm. The 90s did a whole bunch of crazy, wacky stuff. Some of it very successful. Some of it not very successful.
They were doing that as far back as the 40s. You see panels that have like, you know, I've seen some, you know, old golden age artists who just did stuff that just had white borders, but no actual hard lines around them. Some Will Eisner stuff like that, where it's like
Will Eisner.
Edge,
I would consider definitely one of the most advertorial, designy sort of panel artists. Right?
I think
I know Steranko gets a lot of credit
for the design stuff.
Yeah, because he was in advertising for years and years.
Yeah.
And then obviously went into comics, but he also, you know, worked off a lot of Jack Kirby layouts to begin his career. So. But I think Steranko always had really fantastic covers. He had that principle. You know, think of the famous Captain America.
All
the pyramid sort of shapes and things like that.
Yeah, power shapes like that.
So. Yeah, so widely credited with a lot of sort of advertorial graphic design principles.
But I also, Darwin Cook worked in advertising forever.
Yeah.
So I think there are these really good guys who spend a lot of time in advertising. And I think when you understand how to pull emotion out of people, I think that it translates well into comic book storytelling.
But then the flip side, somebody... is it Mitch Gerards?
Rich Gerards.
Gerards, is that what it is?
Yes.
Didn't they do their entire Mr. Miracle series in the 9-panel grid?
Yeah.
And it was like 12 issues in a row of the exact same, you know, right?
Watchmen does it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there's fun internal governors that you can put on yourself.
Yeah, you can
amazing storytelling.
Yeah, you can lean into the emotionality of it, or you can, do some formal exploration, right? I mean, that's formal exploration, right? So, part of the impact of the story is the evenness of the beats, right? I mean, that's kind of how Watchmen works. It's how, mm-hmm. Mr. Miracle works. I mean, there is
super cool.
There is a feeling to that kind of like, you know, even beats of everything and occasionally having stuff that like maybe now it's two panels instead of one. But I mean, again, that is the boundary. I mean, every good designer has a set of boundaries to work within. And I think the best designers will impose those on themselves.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Because on one hand, you want to say the rules are there are no rules.
Yep.
If we're talking about comics.
Oh, right?
I mean, we were talking about the Inky Knuckles crew at Heroes, mm-hmm. and I was just looking through some of Brian Levell's pages, right? And he did I believe it's a Darth Vader book or whatever like that. And he's got panel designs that like this. It's a silhouette of a TIE fighter, right?
Oh, yeah,
very
yeah.
like very cool. He's got triangle. I mean, he's doing all sorts of things, right? But it's not that there are no rules. It's mm-hmm. that, hey, as long as you stick and adhere to the guidelines and the principles mm-hmm. of the story that you're telling and stay within that. It's not being crazy just to be crazy.
Well, it all speaks
to... It works
to,
within that story.
It speaks to a curated reality, and that when you adhere to it, garners a lot of trust from your audience.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like, you know, I always say that comics are a magic trick. And what you do when you lean hard into confessing its artifice... which is a quote I got from John Updike, all great art has a need to confess its artifice. So when you confess its artifice with something like a super limited color palette or 9-panel grid on every page.
I love those books though that use a limited color palette.
So what you're saying to the reader is, I'm going to show you a magic trick.
Yeah.
This is made up. This isn't real.
Yeah.
You're not pretending to be a wizard. You're no, but there is a, when you confess the artifice, when you're like, this is made up, and then you can then you still pull emotion out of them,
yeah,
or you still wow them with the trick.
Yeah.
It's even more impactful because they know it's not real. They know it was a trick.
Exactly.
You know, if I say I'm going to do a magic trick and then I do something that you can't, you know I'm not a wizard,
yeah,
but I do something you can't explain with like modern, like with how you understand physics, you are even more blown away.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I, at the onset, you know, just by graphic design sense, and a lot
shout
of that
out
is
David Blaine.
A lot of that is you know, things like color choices and panel selection. That,
yeah.
And if you you set your rules and you adhere to them, you're repeatedly reinforcing the idea, this is a curated reality.
Yeah.
I am telling you a story. This is a story. This is a story. So when you pull some emotion out of that, they're even more blown away because they know it's not real. They know it's a story, but they're still emotionally involved in it.
Well, sometimes creativity isn't necessarily defined by wide open spaces, and you can do anything to everyone with unlimited budget. You know, it's the proverbial white paper with anything, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes the best creativity comes from a hard set of rules that are limiting you, and then it's what can you play with the toys within that sandbox.
It's why the first Matrix movie is great and the second two are garbage, or the second three now are garbage because they had all the money in the world.
Yeah.
When you had to be smart about where you spent your money. Now it's just like, hey, I know we can't put a lot of money into the shop, but we can get a cool camera angle, can't we?
Yeah.
We can light it cool, can't we? Yeah. I mean, like those sorts of things. But when you're like, oh, we can just CGI everything and you can do anything, it's kind of nothing.
Well,
so, yeah.
There's that, but then they overlay that with story choice.
Oh, yeah. So I mean, absolutely that. I mean, it might have helped with the story. Yeah. It'd be even in somewhat compelling.
So. All right. Before we wrap it up, any other final thoughts on the blending of
I think the mechanics of it, too, are, you know, at some point with your comic book, someone has to put it in a page layout program and create a PDF that is printable.
Yeah.
And that understanding that aspect, I think, of comic creation, even if you're an artist, even if you never intend to lay your book out.
Yeah.
You should understand what, you know, pagination is, what, you know, imposition is.
Well, I know that for both of us with clients, there's the ongoing battle of hey, we want to delete that page. Sorry, you can't do that because I need three other pages to go with it.
What other three do you want to come in? I'm like, what? Like,
It's like, hold on a second. These three, you know, I can't tell you. I mean, now that, you know, post-pandemic, we're in such a Zoom, Google Hangout, all the different, you know, is literally making little dummies and holding them up.
Exactly.
You know, it's so much fun.
Here's the book. And when I take it apart, you can see. Here's one and eight. And
only when we do perfect bound catalogs, which we're doing one right now. Actually, Mike's working on that right now.
But you still got to do two pages at a time.
Exactly.
You know,
and
you're wasting paper at that. You know, you're incurring paper cost. You know, and that might push you beyond a parent page. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. So sorry.
I'm the one that pulled you off.
Yeah. So I think that having an understanding of just like where the ink meets the paper, I think that is huge for a comic artist to understand.
Absolutely.
Whether or not they intend to do it. You know, like exactly. Is this web press? Is this offset lithography?
We could talk for the next like 6 hours about all of these things.
I mean, there were guys who were unhappy with, like, you showed me that Gene Colan page. Yeah. I know Colan was super unhappy with the way that his work worked, or the way his work came out when it got actually printed.
Yeah.
You know, because they're doing flexo plates on the newsprint, like the dot gain on that. So that's direct press, right?
Exactly.
The plates make contact with the paper.
Yeah.
So not only is the ink hitting the paper, it's being pushed into the paper.
Exactly.
And it's newsprint, so it is just toilet paper.
Pulpy.
Yeah, it's going to just soak everything. So any fine line you have. So, and if that's your printing process, tell me, what is my point size? What's the maximum point size I can have, or the narrowest point size I can have that won't bleed out? If I do a half point gap between lines, is that just going to choke into black, or can I actually... You know, can I actually get space in a half point line?
Well, we're both classically trained this way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I learned how to cut, you know, film.
Yeah, Rubylith.
Yeah,
Amberlith.
I can use a stat camera. I've been burned on a waxer. You know,
We did, you know, hand labeled registration marks.
Yeah,
you know, what I mean, where you had
you
to
cut the little wedge out of them so that they stack on top of each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I have burned myself on a waxer. Mm-hmm. I think guys who know what a waxer smells like are few and far between in this business.
Well, I've told this story before on the podcast of what got me into design. In the first place, and really it was working in a print shop and just cleaning Heidelberg. You know, I had to run four color jobs on a two color Heidelberg press.
Oh man,
you know what I mean? And then clean them in between, right?
Is that direct press or is it offset?
It was offset,
okay.
And it was like,
should we explain that to people? So any comic artist who maybe stumbled upon this because of me or maybe you. So an offset press, offset lithography, the plate never hits the paper.
Yeah.
It hits a blanket. The blanket hits the paper.
Correct.
So that is the offset and offset lithography.
Yeah.
So your plate never actually touches the paper. So there is a little bit of generation loss between the blanket and actually hitting the paper.
But it's supposed to overcome the dot gain.
Exactly.
Of pushing it in. Right. I mean, that was the technology, you know, when it was created, that was the technological sell was actually, it's going to be a better printed sheet.
You can also work faster.
Yeah.
That's a part of the advantage as well. So, but know that. And then also know the type of paper, coated versus uncoated.
Absolutely.
Is this absorption print versus evaporative print? Is it in the paper or on the paper?
Yeah.
You know, and then also just in like fulfillment considerations, like If it's evaporative, you can get that pretty quickly because it's going to dry. But if it's absorption, there's a day to dry before you can do any bindery function.
Well, I tell you what, in the summertime down here in Atlanta,
I can't imagine.
I'll tell you what, we've designed some things over the years. Full, I mean, you know us designers, we
want full bleed,
you know, the whole everything, right? And it'll be like, dude, it's a week later. We can't send this to finishing because it's still wet.
Still wet.
Can't it's still put it tacky.
You can't get any bindery function.
Yeah, yeah. It's like there isn't a humidor big enough for these giant, you know.
And then nowadays, so before it was just about providing the proper mechanical artboards to be shot to film, to then be shot on plates. Nowadays, everything's direct to plate and it comes from digital files.
Yeah.
But also understand there's a rip between you and that plate.
Yeah.
And understand that rip, whatever color profile you were looking at, whatever color profile you were thinking, the rip is going to override that.
Absolutely.
And so
unless you set your stuff up,
it behooves you to ask your printer.
Tell the people what,
Your color profile. Hey man, can I, this is the conversation you need to have. Email your printer. Can I get the color profile for your rip so I make sure that my CMYK model is correct?
Yeah.
Absolutely. They'll send you back. It's US swap. It's whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever they're they might have something proprietary. They can send you those little executables that you just install automatically.
9 times out of 10, though, it's the US swap, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is. And most people operate under US swap.
Yeah.
However, a lot of Image, if you work for Image Comics, used to go to Canada to get printed.
Really?
It was all Quebecor. Yeah.
Okay,
it's Quebecor's not a lot. They have a new printer. I think they're also in Canada.
Okay.
Gotta ask, you know, and even if you're providing PDFs, if you want to do your own design work, like put your back matter and what have you, again, you got to know how to set pagination, make sure your page counts are correctly.
Well,
you got to know how to set a, you know, a file up with a spine on it, you know, and you know, have your proper dial line.
Oh yeah.
And Image was very particular about how the file name extensions and like how you named your pages so that they knew it, like, you know, they had like a 01-0 whatever, you know, like it had to be two
digits.
There's
a system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you got to ask questions about deliverables before you start creating, because if you got to go back and retroactively do it, probably going to mess you up.
Yeah, plus if you do a big thick book, right, that's not perfect bound but still saddle stapled,
yep,
it's 36, 64, whatever the case may be, right?
Yeah.
You've also got the face trim, right?
Yep. Oh yeah.
Because the way the paper folds over and then it sort of alligator steps out, right?
Yeah.
You're gonna
so pages 22 and 25 they're gonna lose about 1/3 of an inch.
I was about to say they're gonna get lopped off, right?
Yep,
so if you design it, let's say you do the 9x9 grid and the same exact margin all the way around for every single page, well, guess what?
It's getting pushed out. Like,
you're not gonna have the same margin. I know.
But there are rip programs before they make the plates that will actually nudge things in and out.
Yeah.
So that's why you give them sometimes, you'll provide a little more bleed so that they have some room to play in, and they'll actually accommodate for the thickness of the paper as it starts coming off.
Yeah.
And even with perfect bound stuff, it'll sometimes do that, but still, you know, make sure, you know the people you're going to deliver it to before you build it.
Absolutely.
And then build it accordingly. And then also understand, you know, like if you need to set your own dial lines, like know how to set like an overprinted spot color that comes out on its own plate.
Exactly.
There's a lot of little things that comic artists get baffled by. Like, I don't know why this printed. Like, you can see the trim line actually on there. Right?
Yeah.
I said it was trim. Like, well, did you set it to overprint? Did you set it on its own color swatch?
Well, I think the next big hurdle everyone's going to have to, and we don't have to talk about this, but but everyone, because we're already at a half hour here,
that
everybody's going to, is, you know, Pantone decoupling from Adobe.
Oh God, that is
right.
Big. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I mean, that's a disaster for us, and we're a full fledged agency that does all. You know, and it's
I got a CMYK book, and I use that. I have used that for a while because Pantone has been kind of dead, you know, for about a decade now. You know, like nobody prints, you know, Pantone jobs, or like, you know, they'll do like a 2-color job or 3-color job. And then also, you know, it used to be like, oh, we'll figure out what the client's Pantone color is, and then we'll find the CMYK breakdown, and hopefully it's a color that doesn't shift too much.
Close, never are.
It's just, you know, the world lives in CMYK or RGB right now, and we're moving more toward RGB.
We are moving more towards RGB. Yeah. I can't tell you how many clients give me their hex reference.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that won't print right.
Yeah,
like, I don't know what to tell you. That neon green
CMYK,
you've got, that is not a color.
Yeah.
You know?
And then you got to navigate some weird approximation. Yeah.
Again,
to get
it's a conversation for, I mean, color still, is exponentially.
But, you know, there's the thing right there. If you work in comics, you should understand the difference between additive light theory and subtractive light theory.
Yeah.
You should know the difference between a hex color and a CMYK breakdown.
Totally.
You know, everyone knows it's super black, but like, why is it super black? What is your saturation levels?
We call it rich black down here.
Right? Oh, I know. Yeah. I got you. So,
what's your favorite rich black?
60/40/40/100.
Okay.
Do you
60,
do the 90?
60/40/40/100. Now, I'll do, you're not far off. I mean, 60/40. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad.
And it used to be the rich black used to be that weird like 56, 54. I think it was like 62, 56, 54.
Yeah, it's in the 59s or something.
Yeah, yeah.
There was...
I'm sorry. You're young. You're old enough to remember this. Do you remember having to manually set your screen angles in Photoshop so you wouldn't get moire patterns?
Yes.
Could you rattle those off the top of your head?
Absolutely not.
Probably. I know it's yellow is 90 and black is 0. And
couldn't tell you.
Yep.
I couldn't tell you. I do know. I'm old enough to remember Photoshop without layers.
Yep. Yeah. Photoshop 3.
Yeah.
That's where it started.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
That was the first commercially available Photoshop. Yeah.
Layers. Yeah. It's crazy. I'm trying to think. We have one publication for our rich black, and it's a trapping thing, and it's a dot gain thing. It's how much ink coverage per sheet because they print on such thin.
Oh yeah, yeah. I used to work on those AMS colors for newspapers. Did you ever do that?
No. Yeah, I want to say one of our rich blacks is like it's like in the 20s. It's like a 30-30-20. You know, it's like one of those things. So
anyway. Yeah, I mean, I got you. But you know, nowadays, and again, there's the thing is I can set it to 60-40-40-100, right?
Yeah.
And that's my rich black, and then I'll do color holds, what have you. I'll make my PD, or I'm sorry, I make my printable, you know, document, and I drop PD. Yeah. I've dropped PSDs into my InDesign document, and then output that at whatever the color profile is, so that I'm not having to approximate or interpret, you know, a color profile just from RGB to CMYK. When I flatten my PSD and then make a TIFF out of it, then have, you know, there's a little bit of compression artifact in that half, tiny bit that. Enough, but then you do it again when you make your PDF, and then it's going to happen again when the rip happens.
So, I see what happens.
So like I literally with my printer, I will give them InDesign documents with placed PSDs in them, and then let them
rip
on the rip. Yeah, exactly. And that way, there's only one step where it's being flattened and compressed. There's only one shift that can hopefully happen.
Yeah.
And I tell them what my rich black ideally would look like.
But,
I mean, and there's a little bit of graphic design I think every comic artist could benefit from.
For sure.
Yeah,
for
but if you are making TIFFs, get your color profile before you send it.
I mean, totally.
It's a simple email, people.
Sorry. All right. This has been, again, we could talk about this for another, you know, 12 hours. All right. Where can everybody find you, Gonzo?
I'm making YouTube videos at Jay Gonzo. Those are the things that are germane to this, where I'm talking kind of about my... you know, this is my 30th year as a graphic designer, so kind of my theory about graphic design.
If you want to
check out my Instagram, I'm on jgonzoart, and I'm a Lamano comic on Twitter if you dare venture into Twitter. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, Instagram's a much better follow. jgonzoart, all one word, no underscores.
Perfect. Thanks, bud. All right. Everybody can find us at mocktheagency.com, or you can look us up on the socials at mocktheagency. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Gonzo.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.